ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमम् देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जायाम् उदीरयेत्. We're doing number 15, is that right?
Yeah.
Sorry?
16.
Shri Raja Uvacha.
Shri Raja Uvacha.
Kena.
Kena.
Upayena.
Upayena.
Bhagavan.
Bhagavan.
Kale.
Kale.
Doshan.
Doshan.
Kalo.
Kalo.
Jana.
Jana.
Vidamishyanti.
Vidamishyanti.
Upachitan.
Upachitan.
Tat
me
bruhi yata
mune.
Shri Rajovacha
keno
payena
bhagavan,
keno payena
bhagavan,
kale doshan kalo jhana. Vidamishyan upachittam. Vidamishyan upachittam. Tanme bruhi yata mune.
Tanme bruhi yata mune.
Shri Raja Uvacha. King Parikshit said, Kena, by what? Upayena, means, Bhagavan, my dear Lord, Kale, of the age of Kali, Doshan, defaults, Kalo, living in Kali Yuga, Jana, people, Vidamishyanti, will eradicate, Upachitan, accumulated, Tat, that, may, to me, Bruhi, please explain, Yata, fittingly, Mune, O sage. Translation. King Parikshit said, my dear Lord, how can persons living in the age of Kali rid themselves of the cumulative contamination of this age? O great sage, please explain this to me. Purport. King Parikshit was a compassionate, saintly ruler. Thus, after hearing of the abominable activities of the age of Kali, he naturally inquired as to how those born in this age can free themselves of its inherent contamination. Next verse, text 17. Yugani yugadharmamscha manam pralaya kalpayo kalasya sheshwara rupasya Gatim Vishnu Mahatmana. Please explain the different ages of universal history, the special qualities of each age, the duration of cosmic maintenance and destruction, and the movement of time, which is the direct representation of the Supreme Soul, the personality of Godhead, Lord Vishnu. Next verse, text number 18. Shri Sukha Uvacha kṛte pravartate dharmas chatus pattar janai dhṛta satyam daya tapo dhanam iti pada vibho nṛpa. Translation: Sukadeva Goswami said, "My dear king, in the beginning, during Satya Yuga, the age of truth, religion is present with all four of its legs intact and is carefully maintained by the people of that age. These four legs of powerful religion are truthfulness, mercy, austerity, and charity." Purport: Just as there are four seasons, there are four ages of the earth, each lasting hundreds of thousands of years. The first of these is Satya Yuga, when such good qualities as charity are prominent. Actual charity here, referred to as dhanam, is to award fearlessness and freedom to others, not to give them some material means of temporary pleasure or relief. Any material charitable arrangement will inevitably be crushed by the onward march of time. Thus, only realization of one's eternal existence beyond the reach of time can make one fearless, and only freedom from material desire constitutes real freedom, for it enables one to escape the bondage of the laws of nature. Therefore, real charity is to help people revive their eternal spiritual consciousness. Religion is here referred to as Vibhu, the mighty, because universal religious principles are not different from the Supreme Lord Himself and ultimately lead one to His kingdom. The qualities mentioned here, truthfulness, mercy, austerity, and charity, are universal non-sectarian aspects of pious life. In the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, the fourth leg of religion is listed as cleanliness. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, this is an alternative definition of the word dhanam in the present context. So here in this chapter, it's more or less continuing to explain the situation in the age of Kali. In text 16, we have Maharaj Parikshit asking what people in the age of Kali should do, considering it's such a difficult age to be in. He's asking them what can they do in order to free themselves from the challenges of the age. And we see something similar happening in the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. We may remember there is one chapter, Questions by the Sages, I think it's chapter 2 of the first canto. And they're doing the same thing. They had gathered for a sacrifice in the forests of Naimisharanya, also knowing that Kali Yuga was upon them, was upon the world. And Suta Goswami, who had just returned from hearing the Bhagavatam, along with Parikshit Maharaj and so many others from Sukadeva Goswami, he had just returned to that assembly of sages where he belonged. He was from that group of sages, and he had gone on pilgrimage, and in the process he had heard the Srimad Bhagavatam at the same time as Parikshit Maharaj. Although it was specifically being told to Parikshit that many other sages were there, and Suta Goswami was among them. So upon returning to his group of sages, the sages of Naimisharanya, then they asked him many questions, as you know, and that's the chapter, the second chapter of the first canto, Questions by the Sages. And one of the questions was, what can the people in this age of Kali, what can they do, considering it's a very unfortunate age, with many unfortunate qualities? What can they do? What can the residents of Kali Yuga do in order to uplift themselves? And the whole Bhagavatam is more or less spoken in response to that. Or is it chapter 1 is questions by the sages? Chapter 2 is Who can remember the title of chapter 2? Chapter 1, I think, is questions by the sages, and then chapter 2 is, yes, divinity and divine service. And in summary, Sutta Goswami responds to the questions, what they can do, and put together, the whole chapter more or less can be said, that he responded that they can uplift themselves through hearing about Krishna. In many verses, that's more or less how he responded. And then, of course, the whole Bhagavatam is a response to the questions by the sages. Not in any particular order, but just generally. So Parikshit Maharaj, he is doing something similar here. Because in one sense, of course, Parikshit Maharaj, his conversation with Sukadev Goswami begins in Canto 2. Canto 1 more or less sets the stage. Similar to the Bhagavad Gita, we have chapter 1 of the Bhagavad Gita. Nothing much is going on, except that everyone is being introduced. The battlefield situation is being introduced. How Arjuna observes the family and friends on either side, and he becomes overwhelmed with lamentation. And how he declines to fight. So it sets the stage. Chapter 1 sets the stage for the Bhagavad Gita being spoken. And then, as we know, in chapter 2, Krishna begins to speak, going through to, well, of course, through to chapter 18. But chapter 18, more or less, is a summary of everything Krishna spoke from chapter 2 to chapter 17. He's more or less restating what he has spoken in all the other chapters. That's what chapter 18 is. And the Bhagavatam is somewhat similar, in the sense that the first canto sets the stage. It introduces everyone, who are the actors in the drama, and it explains their history, who is Parikshit, who were his grandparents, Sukadev, who is Sukadev, and Vyasadev. So it sets the stage. It introduces everyone and sets the stage. And then in canto 2, Sukadev Goswami begins to speak, and the rest of the, from 2 to 11, it's a collection of conversations in conversations in conversations. Many conversations. The Bhagavatam is a conversation. And Sukadev Goswami relates a conversation, and then that conversation often relates another conversation, which relates another conversation. And that's the whole Bhagavatam. And then in the 12th canto here, Sukadev Goswami is again summarizing, more or less, restating everything that he has related in the previous cantos. And in this particular verse, these two verses, 16 and 17, Parikshit Maharaj is asking, firstly, what should people do in this age to relieve themselves from the contamination of the age of Kali? And then in the next verse, in text 17, he asks something about the history, the overall history of the world. The different ages of universal history, the duration of the cosmic maintenance and destruction, the movement of time. So more or less he's asking for an overview of the material world. And in the following chapters, Sukadev Goswami will respond. And in these verses, there's a summary, again, of the four ages, of which we are all very familiar. In the 11th canto, there is also a detailed description of the four ages, and their qualities and symptoms, and who the Yuga avatars are for that particular age. And in this chapter, the Bhumi Gita, Sukadev Goswami again summarizes the qualities of the four ages. So in text number 18, he had begun to describe the age of Satya Yuga, the age of truth, Religion is present with all four of its legs intact and is carefully maintained by the people of that age. These four legs of powerful religion are truthfulness, mercy, austerity, and charity. Of course, we have heard about the four yugas many a time. And generally, we understand that from Satya Yuga, everything is ideal and then gradually becomes less. And of course, this view of history, this view of the world, is very much at odds with the modern world's view of history. In the modern world's view of history, of course, we evolved. That we were either primates or less at some point in time. And then we evolved into the pinnacle of what we are now. Civilized human society. This is the best we've ever been. The most advanced we have ever been. The most enlightened we have ever been, because we allow everything to happen. Basically, that's why we're enlightened. We're free, we're open-minded and liberal, and we allow anybody to think whatever they like, more or less, within basic boundaries. But because we allow anyone to think whatever they like, everybody is equally correct, generally speaking, everybody is equally correct. Everybody's rights must be equally accepted. Everybody's habits, within boundaries of course, must be equally accepted. And that's enlightenment. That's considered, in the present day, that is considered progressive human society. But if they were to read the predictions of the age of Kali as being the most degraded state of human existence, then certainly they would have a lot of objections. Certainly they would have a lot of objections. Of course, some people can, a lot of people probably, I think most people would probably accept that the world is a very messy place and it has become more materialistic and people are more selfish and so on. And you get many people more or less agreeing with that critique of modern society. But simultaneously, the answer that they would give is certainly not in the line of, you know, spiritual evolution or upliftment or education. Rather, the answer would be democracy. If everyone is democratic, if all the governments of the world were to put in place democratic principles, then that will save all the barbarism of the world, because it's, as the theory tells us, human beings know what's good for them. That's more or less what democracy is all about. Human beings, they know what's good for them, and eventually they'll figure it out, if you just give them a chance. Eventually they'll figure it out, they'll choose what is good for them. Just give them their time, throw all the ideas out there, whatever they might be, and they'll choose the best one. And what's the role model for that? America. And everybody's complaining about it now anyway. But they're the role model for this kind of open, enlightened, progressive society. But simultaneously, you know, including Americans themselves, everybody's critiquing them from A to Z. You know, there's nothing right in what they're doing. So this is how they see their relief. Of course, Sukadeva Goswami has a very different response. How, of course, Parikshit Maharaj is asking, how can the people of Kali rid themselves of the contamination of the age? And of course, later in this chapter and the rest of the Bhagavatam, he will respond. And then if we, again, same, if we were to ask the average, you know, educated, materialistic person, how would we overcome the problems of the age of Kali? Mostly they would say through genetics. You know, we can manipulate our genes in a way to create superhuman beings so we can overcome disease and death and so on. That would be one answer in a very technical sense. And another answer would be through the system of, or the process of democracy. Eventually human beings will choose, you throw everything out there, and as we mentioned, they'll eventually choose what's best. So devotees, in one sense, were quite pessimistic. And Prabhupada actually, he did say, in order to advance in Krishna consciousness, we must be, or we need to be, at least to some extent, pessimistic. If we view everything as being nice and getting better, then there's not much motivation for us to advance in Krishna consciousness. After all, why did most of us become devotees? Because of? Sorry? Mostly, yes. At least mixed. But material distress, maybe there was some aspect of wanting to search for the absolute truth and, you know, be a better person and so on. That, those factors were certainly there, but certainly in many, most cases probably it was very much pushed forward because of our distress, our experiences of distress, and we come for some relief from the effects of the age of Kali. So that's a kind of pessimism. We have tried in so many different ways to fulfill ourselves, and nothing really seems to work as much as we want it to. Sometimes even Krishna consciousness doesn't seem to work as much as we want it to. Or we would like it to, initially anyway. So this is our philosophy. More or less, you know, it has a pessimistic slant. Definitely, it has a, at least about the material world, it does have a pessimistic slant. And it reminds us again and again, I mean, why would, you know, the Bhagavatam talk so much about the age of Kali? You know, for the last three chapters almost, and there's still more to come in this chapter, it's again and again saying Kali Yuga is like this, Kali Yuga is like that, Kali Yuga is like that. I mean, how many times do you need to say it? If it's not enough that we read it in the newspapers or watch it on the news, already we read so much about, you know, the distraught nature of the material world, and then we open the Bhagavatam for some relief, and then, oh, Kali Yuga is like this, Kali Yuga is like that, this is going to happen, that's going to happen, you're going to suffer, it's going to get worse. But it's to again remind us, of which we need quite a lot, that it is a nasty place. The world is a nasty place. It always has been a nasty place. And although, you know, many wonderful things are said about Satya Yuga and Treta Yuga and even Dwapara Yuga, but still there's a lot of nasty things going on during that. I mean, Hiranyakashipu, which he was Satya Yuga, and he was certainly a nasty person, and so many other examples are there. But it's a nasty world, and it's meant to be nasty. Of course, we don't want to be overly pessimistic, but some extent of healthy pessimism is certainly healthy. Of course, too much of anything is not healthy. Too much pessimism is also not healthy. And it's not uncommon when we speak to people or try to share Krishna consciousness with them and say a little bit about the suffering nature of the world, sometimes they can't relate. Actually, they, you know, a number of people do feel, you know, quite good about their life and the world in which they live. And they really do feel that things are getting better, and of course, you know, some things are going wrong, but that's to be expected. Give it another few years and we'll overcome it. But a lot of people feel everything is getting better, and you know, they're quite happy with their life and their relationships. I mean, there's a number of people like that. So we don't want to overdo it. We don't want to come across as, you know, some fatalistic, defeatist people who couldn't find a job and therefore we became a Hare Krishna monk or something. We don't want to come across like that. But there are a lot of optimistic, you know, people, and of course something that's very quite common in the present day and age is to be optimistic. Or be good about everything. Or why you're so pessimistic, you know, it's a very common, just be positive. And there's a lot of this positive reinforcement that, you know, people like to put out there. To be positive and don't see the negative and etc. You know, it goes on and on. You go to any bookshop and the section, you know, there's a whole self-help section. There's always quite a big section, especially in the big bookshops, the self-help section. How many books are there talking about self-help, positive thinking and so on and so forth? Health and self-help, they're always the biggest sections. And then of course fiction. That's another huge section in bookshops. Probably they're the biggest section, and management and business. Then you go to the humanities section, you know, current affairs, it's generally the smallest section. And next to that would be, you know, spirituality or religion. It's also generally not a very large section. But for self-help and fiction and management and business, they're always the biggest sections in bookshops, ultimately. So it's very common, you know, for people to want to be positive, and we want to be positive also, and we should be positive, because Krishna consciousness is a very positive thing. It is a very positive thing, and the fact that we have come in contact with Krishna consciousness in spite of the unfortunate nature of Kali Yuga is a very wonderful thing. It is a very positive thing that happened to us in our lives. And we should be positive about it. And we have to be able to share that positiveness, not just with our, you know, philosophical discourse, but we should be able to share or influence give that positive energy to others. Because ultimately, as the philosophy so many times has said, souls are looking for happiness. It's the nature of the soul to look for happiness. And in our preaching of Krishna consciousness or in our association with others, we want to give them that happiness. At least we should want to give them that happiness, the positive aspect of Krishna consciousness. But in order to give that, of course, we have to feel it ourselves. If we don't feel it ourselves, what we say might sound very positive, but it won't go very far if we don't feel it ourselves. Because bhakti, more or less, bhakti means emotion. Devotion means emotion. And through our practice, we should be feeling some emotional content. And if we read Krishna's relationships and activities, pastimes with his devotees, there's a lot of emotional intensity going on there. You wouldn't say it's a plain process. There's a lot of emotional content, you know, going back and forth between the Lord and his devotees. And we also should, through our practice, should be able to reach this emotional content that is part and parcel of the existence of the soul. It is the soul, you know, this emotional content is the nature of the soul, to be happy and to express happiness. And in our sharing of Krishna consciousness, that is part of our preaching, is how we express or how we are able to share the happiness or the optimism that we experience in Krishna consciousness. And certainly it's a challenge because, again, it's a nasty world. And, you know, there's a lot of things not going right. And after all, we are struggling conditioned souls, even though we are practicing, we are struggling conditioned souls. But having said all that, you know, often the nature of our natures are we see what we don't have. We don't have this in a material context and even in a spiritual context. As devotees, we often see, you know, we don't have Krishna Prema. Oh no. It's, you know, of course, Krishna Prema is really quite, it is very distant. It is very distant. In a sense, it's a very far away stage to achieve. And of course, we read so much about achieving Krishna Prema throughout our teachings. And it is a very far away achievement in one sense anyway. And a lot of the advanced stages of devotional service appear to be quite far away. Even Nishtha, the stage of steadiness, occurs after we have overcome our material desires and allurements and attractions to the world. Then we come to the stage of Nishtha, where we're fixed. Internally and externally, we are fixed. Even that, in one sense, is quite far away. And that's, you know, still from there to Krishna Prema is even further away. So in some ways it can seem to be quite a, well, challenge to be happy in Krishna consciousness, to be optimistic in Krishna consciousness, whilst not allowing, you know, the influence of Kali Yuga to pull us under. It is certainly a struggle. Can be, at least sometimes anyway. It is certainly a struggle to, you know, as we say in English, to keep our head above the water. We can only tread water for so long, as Prabhupada would tell us. You're either swimming or you're sinking, basically. We can only stay in one place for so long. So we have to swim or we have to sink. And we can say, anyway, in the material world we have to struggle. Whoever we are, there's a struggle for existence. Most people don't have it so easy. And those that do, if they have it financially easy, they're struggling in other ways. So anyway, we have to struggle. One way or the other, life is a struggle. And if we struggle in Krishna consciousness, then certainly there is some... It's a worthwhile struggle. It is certainly a worthwhile struggle. And Krishna reciprocates. I mean, if we think, how many lifetimes have we not been looking at Krishna? I mean, a countless number of lifetimes. And even when a soul turns to Krishna, it's a huge step. Million, billion, count eternal number of lifetimes we're looking away from Krishna, consciously. And then in one lifetime a soul turns towards Krishna. You know, the step, it's a huge step. Point being, we shouldn't always be seeing or lamenting about what we don't have, but rather we should be seeing what we do have. And we have a lot. I mean, how long ago did Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appear? 520 years ago or something? And that was the first time in Lord Brahma's day. And how long is Lord Brahma's day? I don't remember the numbers, but there's, you know, a few trillion years there. And Mahaprabhu, he only appeared, 530 years ago? And we might be, you know, struggling and foaming in the mouth, trying to follow the path of Krishna consciousness. But Mahaprabhu only appeared, you know, 530 years ago. We can go to Mayapur and visit his birthplace and visit so many pastime places where he was there with Nityananda Prabhu and so many other associates. You know, we can visit these places. Other Kali Yugas, there was no Mayapur to go. I mean, maybe there was a Mayapur, but... Well, there was. There always is a Mayapur. It's eternal, but... It certainly was not as revealed as it is now in this present age. So we have a lot going for us. And if we were to learn more how to appreciate what we have and how to take advantage of what we have, then there's a lot to be happy about. There's a lot to be positive about. Whilst at the same time having a healthy perspective of the pointless nature of the material world. In some verses prior to this, I think in this chapter, Sukadev Goswami says, oh yes, it's in text 14. He says, Sukadev Goswami said, Almighty Parikshit, I have related to you the narrations of all these great kings who spread their fame throughout the world and then departed. My real purpose was to teach transcendental knowledge and renunciation. Stories of kings lend power and opulence to these narrations, but do not in themselves constitute the ultimate aspect of knowledge. So that, as Sukadeva Goswami says, two reasons. One reason, of course, many of the kings were great devotees. So he related their histories. And because it's a Purana, Puranas relate the genealogies of kings. But another reason why was to inspire some renunciation within Parikshit. That looks, oh, you're not the only one. Maybe you're going to die in, well, this would be the sixth day, I guess, if he was speaking the 12th canto. This could be the last day, his last day on the earth, the seventh day. So, giving him some comfort. What to speak of you, all these other great kings of the past, who were in many ways more powerful than Parikshit. And there was one list previously in this chapter. He mentions even Rama and Prithu, many great, of course, avatars and other great, you know, devotee kings, Raghu and Mandata and so on. What to speak of you, even all of these great kings, they conquered the whole world and everything and everyone, Bharat. But through the force of time, they were also wiped away, and they also simply became accounts in books. So when we hear that, then of course, we would think, it helps us to develop a sense of detachment, at least it should. Help us to develop. And that's what history does, even in a mundane context. You know, we hear so many great empires and people, and then, you know, one day they control the world or a country, and the next day they're gone, and you really don't hear about them anymore. And after 100 years, who remembers them? Again, they're just a name in a book. So for someone who is reflective, it will help them, us, understand the impermanence of this world. And that's why it helps to be a bit pessimistic, because that helps to strengthen our detachment from things material. And that's something that age does for you, naturally. You know, of course, when we're all in our 20s, you know, we're all optimistic about so many things. By the time you're 40 or 50, you've seen a bit of life and you think, well, you know, nothing's so bright after all. Not in a negative sort of a sense, but just in a, you know, realistic sense. Because we don't want to be negative again, too negative, but we want to be realistic. And being realistic gives, you know, helps to give us some maturity and detachment, which then will help us in our being able to let go of the inevitable troubles of Kali Yuga. It will inevitably help us to, otherwise we're so attached, we hold on so much to so many little things in our lives. But if we have some detachment, if we can cultivate some detachment, then it will help us let go of and tolerate. It will help us tolerate the inevitable troubles that this age of Kali will bring. And really, that is one of the first teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, is to learn to tolerate happiness and distress like winter and summer. I mean, nobody gets depressed because of winter. Or maybe some people do. But nobody gets depressed because we all know winter is going to come, it's going to be cold, and we have to dress up. Of course, we may not like it, but we learn to live with it, and then we make arrangements to protect ourselves from the winter weather. And nobody gets depressed because of course, in Melbourne you don't have to get depressed because of summer, because it's not very hot. But if you were in India or some other countries, it can, you know, summer can be quite extreme. But again, nobody gets depressed because of summer. We learn to, you know, deal with it and try to minimize its effects upon us. And as Krishna says, winter and summer, happiness and distress comes like winter and summer. It's as predictable. Happiness and distress is as predictable as winter and summer. We can just take it for granted. that you'll have a great day and then you'll have a lousy day. Or you'll have a great part of a day and then you have a lousy part of the day. It's just, we just take it for granted. And if we can cultivate that sense of detachment, which is what Krishna is asking us to do, tolerance. Tolerance requires detachment. If we can develop the strength of tolerance, which comes from detachment, then, you know, the, again, inevitable challenges of Kali Yuga and the inevitable dualities that we experience in this world will much more easily be able to let go of them. And then simultaneously, of course, cultivating the positive aspects of Krishna consciousness. And additionally, of course, as we were mentioning before, as the Bhagavatam tells us, the present age and the present state of humanity is not considered to be the most evolved. And we have to be able to, what was Prabhupada's mission was to teach people that we're not very advanced, and that rather we need to become advanced. And in the past it was much more advanced, and we're supposed to be part of our mission of part of Prabhupada's mission was to give an alternate view of the world and everything in it. And, you know, within our shell of devotees, you know, we assume that it makes perfect sense. And it does make perfect sense to us. But it doesn't make perfect sense to a lot of other people, certainly. And part of Prabhupada's mission was to make sense of it for other people. Was to make sense that life is... there are many lives, for example, and there are many stages of existence, and there is something called the spiritual world, and there is something called, you know, self-realization, and there is something called the soul. A couple of weeks ago, when we went to La Trobe, right, we had the talk for the people who came, and very basic, you know, yoga means, you know, to be a bit spiritual or something. And I was reflecting afterwards, I was thinking, I mean, some of those people, young kids, well, not kids, but young adults, yeah, they're probably in their own way intelligent, smart and educated, but their understanding of basic spiritual concepts was more or less zero. I mean, it was apparent that they didn't or hadn't thought about, am I going to have another life and what will happen? What's going to happen after death? What happened before I was born? I mean, we take these things for granted because we've read the Bhagavad Gita and heard it, and we think, well, you know, everybody would think like that, wouldn't they? But the fact is, a lot of people don't. A lot of people don't. And therefore, if we hear Prabhupada's lectures, particularly in the West, his recorded lectures, more than anything else, he's talking about, you're the soul, you're not the body, and human life is for self-realization. More than any other, that's the point he belabors again and again and again and again. And in India, he talks about demigod worship a lot, because they're stuck up with that. But in the Western countries, it's, you're not the body, you're an eternal soul, the law of karma and human life is for freeing ourselves from the cycle of birth and death. And we take it as very basic, you know, common sense sort of things. But a lot of people, even religious people, they just don't think of it. And, you know, it became more apparent for me in that group that was there a few weeks ago, that it was like, oh, I'm supposed to think about that? Really? Oh, okay. It was like that. And of course, a lot of people are innocent also. And Therefore, again, Prabhupada wanted us to share this whole view of the world, alternate view of the world and life and history and everything, with the people around us. And fortunately, for us, we have Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mercy and presence and blessings, which, you know, offers the joys of Krishna consciousness, not just the struggles of preaching to others. And again, you know, 40 years ago, nobody would imagine that Krishna consciousness would be all over the world. Nobody would have imagined that Krishna consciousness would be all over the world, and it would have influenced as many people as it did, and that as many people took it up as have. And then, you know, if we project into the future another 50 years, I mean, just think, in 100 years, how many devotees might be living around Melbourne Temple? Probably a few hundred, at least. How many are living around the temple now? 100, is it? Maybe? About, you know, just in Bhaktabhavan, what, there's 30 or something. Then we think, you know, after 100 years, and then you think, you know, as long as the tidal wave doesn't come and wash everything away.
Yeah.
And then we think after 200 or 300 years, you know, there could be thousands of people, devotees, I mean, living around, and it will be the same in cities, you know, places all over the world, just due to the nature of time, things expand. So just due to the nature of time, even if we don't actively preach and do all these things, just due to the nature of time, Krishna consciousness is likely to expand. And if we can be a part of that expansion, then that will be to our great fortune. Because as we have heard many times, it is Mahaprabhu's desire that his name will spread to every town and village of the world. It is Prabhupada's desire and the desire of so many great acharyas. So certainly it will be, as Krishna told Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, whether you fight or not, you know, that's second. It's anyway, the battle has been arranged by me. It's my desire. All these people are going to be killed. If you want to participate and offer some service, then that will be to your credit. So in a similar sense, the Sankirtan movement of Mahaprabhu is destined to be there more than it is now. That's a definite. And if we want to participate and offer some service to Mahaprabhu's mission, and to the mission of the great acharyas and Prabhupada, then that will be to our eternal spiritual credit. And if we don't, it will go on anyway. Somebody else, other people will come forward and offer service. But we should always be wanting and willing to offer service to Mahaprabhu's movement and mission in whatever way we can. And definitely, there Mahaprabhu and the great acharyas will reciprocate by helping us forward in our Krishna consciousness, and by helping us overcome our own struggles within, and to overcome the struggles without, you know, the dualities that we experience in the world. So let's finish here. Are there any questions or comments? Yep.
Yes, what is the message of karma? What is the greatest effect? Is it the nature or the nature?
What is the greatest?
The greatest influence on individuals. Is it the nature or is it the nature?
The nature. Sorry, the
nature or the nurture?
Oh, nature or the nurture? Probably both. It doesn't specifically say in the Bhagavatam. I know in nature nurture, it's a whole controversy within the, you know, academic world. How much is it nature, and how much is it nurture? I would only say both.
Someone was to grow up in the forest, not watching TV, and
To some extent, yes, they would. Probably less than a person who was growing up in downtown Melbourne. But yes, they would be. Yes. Inevitably, because it's the age of Kali. So wherever we are, I mean, what to speak of a forest, even the sadhus in the Himalaya mountains are also affected by the age of Kali. And they're consciously, you know, trying to, in one sense, cultivate, you know, spirituality. Even them, in Vrindavan, for example, and Mayapur, even all of these holy places that are holy forests, people are affected also by the age of Kali. Even in such, you know, spiritual places, what to speak of some average standard. Yeah, so we can't escape it, if that's what you're asking. We can't escape the influence of the age of Kali by our geographical location. We need to take shelter of the holy name, which is what Sukadeva Goswami will say later on in this chapter. Nurture. Nurture certainly has a large part, yes. And nurture can change nature, I think, anyway. But there is some need. We're all born in the age means that we, our samskars, in Sanskrit we have the term samskar, means our impressions from past lives are either good or bad, pious or impious. So the fact that we are born in the age of Kali, in, you know, civilization as we know it, is indicative that our samskars or our impressions from the past are not very pious, not very religious, or not very spiritual. That in itself is indicative of that. And so we have that impious nature or samskar. We're susceptible to the sinful acts of Kali, wherever we are, whoever we are. But if we have proper nurture, a proper environment, then we can overcome that, or at least control it. But through devotional service, we can overcome that nature of the age of Kali, which we all, the samskars, we all have them from past activities and karmas and so on like that. Yes?
Even Lord Krishna says, this is Ukaraya Shastra. Temporary and livable. You have to get out. And Anandamaya Vatha, Prabhupada says, that soul is always seeking for prayer. And why people are happy in this material world? Because of illusion. They are thinking their body. Because they are thinking their body, they want to enjoy the body. And therefore, they have so much frustration, so much lamentation, so much disturbance. And even now they are not realizing, in spite of the flood, earthquake, all these tragedies, tsunami and whatnot.
Why say they? Even we're not realizing. Not to speak of they, we ourselves, and we have all the books and the teachings and so many things. Even after all that, we're also not realizing. So, what to speak of they?
But yes. We are on the right path.
Hopefully.
And if we can, as you said.
Yeah.
The whole message of Bhagavatam is.
Yes.
If we do that, and we know that we are pure spiritual soul, we have nothing to do with this world because we are not body, then we can understand.
Yeah.
And we can advance very fast.
Yeah, and then we can reflect as devotees. If we were in a situation like, for example, Japan, and all of our whole home was washed away, all our family, all our goods, everything. And if we were left with only the clothes on our back, how would we respond? I wonder. Because it's not even for a devotee, it wouldn't be. If you saw your whole home washed away in front of you, and your car, and maybe your family, if you see all of that washed away in front of you, or, you know, crushed beneath a building, how would we respond? I know, but in reality, when it actually happened, it would be a great challenge. For many a devotee, it would be a great challenge if we would respond in a positive way, or if we would become depressed, if we would blame Krishna, you know, who knows what would happen. It's easy to judge what other people should be doing in that situation. But if it were actually to happen to us, of course we all pray that we would, you know, think the right thing and depend on Krishna's mercy, and we, of course, we would want to pray that we would be able to respond in the proper Krishna conscious manner. But it would be a great challenge. I'm sure it would be a great challenge. It would be a great challenge. Even with all of our understanding and philosophy and so on, it would be a great challenge.
That is a point of faith.
Yeah.
If we haven't got strong faith, we can't survive.
Yeah, but I'm still, it's the same reflection, something for us to all reflect upon. Yes.
You're talking about how sometimes we take for granted something like you're not the body, you're the spirit soul. And when we do preach, then whoever we preach to, they have certain attachments that are quite sensitive. So how do we, one, find out what their attachment is, and two, preach accordingly? How do we?
Well, that comes from certainly comes from speaking to a lot of people. By preaching a lot, then you get a sense of course, where people are at, what their mindset is. And then, just through time and experience, then we learn how to respond accordingly to their attachments or concerns. I mean, one way is simply to hear them out for a bit. Don't, you know, jump in and start telling them what they should be doing. But just to hear them out. And then we get a sense, the devotees will get a sense of where they're coming from, what their attachments are, and then they can respond accordingly. That's certainly one way to do it, just through time and experience and, you know, preaching or sharing with a lot of people. Otherwise, you know, we can read the scriptures, and it really tells where people are at also, where a, you know, materialistically attached person, where they're at. There's a lot about it in the scriptures also. So by reading and preaching, basically that's how we become more attuned. And as Prabhupada used to say, or others used to say, it's being a preacher is like being a doctor. We need to learn how to read a person. What do they say? Not read, they say something else.
Diagnose,
that's it. Yeah, we need to learn how to diagnose a person's disease and then give the proper, you know, medicine or diet or whatnot as a response. So when we are preaching, it's the same skill we need to develop, which we develop through just ourselves preaching. Being sensitive when we preach, being reflective when we preach Krishna consciousness, we should be reflective and sensitive, and not just think we have all the answers and, you know, I know what I'm talking about. But at the same time have confidence in what we're talking about, but not in an arrogant sort of manner. And by reading, you know, I mean, it's always interesting speaking to people who haven't taken shelter of Krishna consciousness. You know, that the urge is always to defeat them. That's the urge. The urge is, you know, that's nonsense. You know, you have to hear. But it's educational to, you know, hear, if we like to call it that, the nonsense of someone who hasn't taken shelter of Krishna. Then we can reflect, we should reflect, you know, how would I respond or how should I respond to that? And then, you know, look for statements in Prabhupada's teachings, how, etc. So just being reflective and sensitive in our preaching Krishna consciousness. Then gradually over time, and by, of course, watching others, more senior preachers, you know, preach, then we get ideas and skills and so on also. So those are some things. Yes, Prabhu? Last question.
Each and every person has the equal rights to come to the Krishna consciousness, right?
Hmm.
And what is, like, some part of the people, they lose their life in the material world. They didn't get a chance to come into the spirituality and change themselves, because as their family has grown up, as the family background is like they're pulling into fashionable kind of people. What are their children, the name, fame, and whatever they want to do, mm-hmm. material world. And what is the situation in that in those cases?
Well, that's why devotees are supposed to go out and preach Krishna consciousness.
Yeah, of course, we reach to some level, not to the whole world.
Well, we're supposed to. We're supposed to. We're supposed to cover the whole world. That's what Prabhupada wanted. We're supposed to cover the whole world. We're supposed to meet each and every person and give them an opportunity. Whether they take or not is another matter. But that is our service. You ask what happens to them. Not much will happen to them if we don't go and see them. So we can see it as dependent upon us to go out and give people an opportunity to come in contact with Krishna consciousness. And that is why Prabhupada encouraged us to be very actively preaching or distributing books or distributing prasadam, etc. So some contact is there, and then over time, perhaps over lifetimes. I mean, once upon a time, all of us here were one of those people whom you're talking about. Once upon a time, maybe in this lifetime even, perhaps 20 years ago, we were one of those people who just couldn't care less about, you know, religion or spirituality. But through the mercy of the Lord's devotees, or through the mercy of devotion, devotional service somehow, now we are where we are. So the same applies to everybody else. The same applies to everybody else. Maybe some that go and say hello, give them a cookie.
They may be very close to the temple for years together, but they never enter into the temple.
Yeah, maybe next life I'll enter into the temple. Who can say? Maybe next life I'll come into the temple. Again, once upon a time we were one of those people. Probably living in a temple. Maybe even living in a temple. What? Maybe not living in a temple, but you know, maybe we would, you know, deliver the vegetables for 20 years or something. Who knows? And we never took to Krishna consciousness as such in that lifetime anyway. So, once upon a time, we were one of those persons.
We were lucky enough someone has invited us to come.
Yes, exactly. So that's the point.
Yeah.
We invite people.
The message has approached to us. The message has reached to us. So we have seen them.
Yes, that's the point. That we invite people. And it might take a few lifetimes for people to accept the invitation. I mean, it is said, Rupa Goswami does tell us, devotional service generally happens over a number of lifetimes. Generally it happens over a number of... There is some initial contact and then that carries on until we actually surrender to Krishna. Generally that's the process. Okay, I'm going to stop now. It's quite a time. Grantara Srimad Bhagavatam.